The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
But the cross-exam, boy, her responses were disastrous. I mean, do you hate Donald Trump? Yes, of course she does. That's a big deal. When the witness hates the person whose liberty is at stake, that's a big deal. And she's putting out tweets, fantasizing about him being in jail. That really undermines the credibility. The fact that she owes him $500,000, she, by order of a court, owes Donald Trump $500,000 and said, I will never pay him. I will defy a court order. The defense is going to say she's willing to defy a court order. Why? She's not willing to respect an order of a judge. Why is she going to respect this oath she took? So I thought it went quite poorly on cross-exam. At the end of direct, I thought, okay, they got what they needed. But I think the cross is making real inroads.
You know, the statement of the judge that he's surprised there isn't a higher number of objections from the defense is baffling. The defense objected to putting her on the stand. They then objected to the scope of the questioning. And now the judge sounds like Claude Rains saying, I'm shocked, shocked, there's a porn star in my courtroom. Well, you know, if you give a lot of scope to testimony, what did you expect? And the problem with what the judge has done here is that this is an entirely unnecessary witness. It is uncontested that there's an NDA. Whether what happened in their relationship, if there was one, is immaterial to how those payments were denoted by the Trump campaign.
So this was a very big day, a very revealing day. As you see, their case is totally falling apart. They have nothing on books and records, and even something that should bear very little relationship to the case. It's just a disaster for the DA, for the Soros-backed DA. It's a disaster. This whole case is just a disaster.
I think that 71% of Americans have said that he should be put in jail if he is convicted. The other thing I will say,
courtroom. No.
It's not his courtroom.
No.
It's the judge's courtroom. Mm. And so I think that's to right. Make a point, to prove a point, put him in the clink.
Oh,
why not? Put him in the clink.
I don't want this to sound like I'm doing wishful thinking.
Yes.
But which prison would be best?
I know which one.
I'm going to give you Michael. Well, that's what I asked. Number one is Rikers. But, you know, I'm okay if he goes to Alcatraz and they reopen it.
Maybe.
You know, what about Guantanamo Bay? Okay.
Yeah. Well, that'd be close to Mar-a-Lago. Melania can come and visit.
That's right.
So funny. The ladies, the brain dead ladies at The View, fantasizing about Donald Trump going off to prison. If he's convicted, which prison will he go to? This is what passes for commentary in today's news. There's your regime media. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. It certainly makes you appreciate what we endeavor to present every day. Jesus said that the truth is what sets you free. God's word is truth. You can find that in the Gospel of John. You can get to the live video stream of this show every day at trumpetdaily.com. It's 11 a.m. in the central time zone of the United States, or 11:05, I guess, to be precise. Also, the Rumble channel, rumble.com/trumpetdaily. We got a thumbs down before the show even started. What's that all about? If you go to Rumble, you're going to have to give us the thumbs up, send some comments, do your thing. Because there's always those detractors that are out there to criticize even before the show starts. We have our exclusive interview with the conservative commentator, best-selling author, award-winning filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza. That's coming up in just a few minutes. We don't have a whole lot of time for other details, but we did line up a couple of montages about the lawfare that's just backfiring. I mean, they have Stormy Daniels coming in yesterday, and the judge pretends like he doesn't like the details of this supposedly salacious affair, and yet she's there, and it's all meant to smear Donald Trump. Never mind. This is just about a hush money case. It's a clerical error, I guess. Whether it's classified as legal expenses or campaign financing, whatever. But the judge has to bring in the woman. The woman who said, there's no truth to what I said before. And then she flip-flopped. Now she's saying, yeah, there actually was an affair. And she's describing it in all of this sickening detail. And yeah, it's right there in the courtroom. Meanwhile, in Florida, Judge Cannon has basically said, you know what, let's just suspend this case indefinitely because there's lots of things here to be sorted out. And as if on cue, the minds of the regime media, they explode. Here's MSNBC losing its mind over the classified documents case down in Florida. Clip 4.
Because I think we've lost any hope of seeing this trial take place before November. And this is a trial with very serious allegations. Before I was in the Solicitor General's office, I was National Security Advisor at the Justice Department. And I can tell you, Alex, that anyone who did this kind of stuff that Trump's accused of would lose their job immediately, go straight to trial, and go straight to jail. And I'm not going to characterize the motivations of this judge, but this decision and the handling of this case start to finish have been atrocious. And the judge here really tossed overboard our right, the right of the public, the right to a speedy trial. The case is pretty simple. It's, Alex, a guy stole some documents. He hid them. When the government came and looked for them, he lied about it and hid them again. So, you know, that's it. It's not rocket science. And yet this judge has slow walked this thing to death.
It's like the strongest case. I mean, this guy stole nuclear secrets. This guy stole war plans out of a government building on secret war plans and what we would do in invading Iran. This guy sold sensitive secrets that other countries would pay tens of millions of dollars for, probably even more. Stole them, lied to the FBI. Lied to the Justice Department, had his lawyers lie to the FBI, lied to the Justice Department, and then tried to get, according to testimony, his IT director to destroy the cameras, destroy the evidence. When he wouldn't do it, then allegedly we're hearing he tried to flood the rooms, talk to the maintenance guy who also said, nah, I'm not going to do that. So you have the most important case of all the cases brought against Trump. And it's with a judge who's going to make sure it never sees the light of day.
And there you go. The babies are crying because all that they have left is the Bragg case in Manhattan. The circus show in Manhattan. Paying money. a hush money payment, which everybody and their dog does in D.C. and Hollywood. That's all they have left. They can't get the documents case off and run. Jack Smith has nothing in D.C. or in Florida. The Supreme Court has basically squashed it in D.C. and now Judge Cannon in Florida. Well, we could get into a lot more. I'm already overtime. And I want to make sure that we have enough time for our exclusive interview with Dinesh D'Souza on Obama's rage. That's going to be an interesting interview for you to listen in on. Before we show it, though, I just want to play you a clip from Mr. D'Souza's podcast. Yesterday, he commented on his visit to this campus over Sunday and Monday. Listen to clip 3.
I was in Oklahoma City this past weekend, and in fact, through yesterday, Monday, and I gave a lecture at a Christian school and called the Herbert Armstrong University to a terrific crowd. Some of it was from the church community and the school community, but also a bunch of people from Oklahoma City. And one of the questions that came up that got me thinking and becomes the title of today's podcast is, Obama the culprit? Is Obama the culprit? We see so much going around us. So many of us are disturbed by the trajectory of the country. So the question is, when did this kind of downhill slide, this move into political and moral chaos, this overturning of a cherished moral sentiments, when did this sort of begin?
Appreciate the shout out there from Mr. D'Souza, but also it's pretty cool to think that our discussion, what you're about to hear, also led into what he discussed on his podcast upon returning to his home in Texas. So here it is, the exclusive sit down that we had with conservative, best-selling conservative author Dinesh D'Souza from Monday. In my father's book, he wrote this book in 2012, America Under Attack, and he opens the book talking about the swooning media and the captivating influence that Barack Obama had on the media. And just looking at your book, The Roots of Obama's Rage, this is why your book really got our attention, because you were one of the rare exceptions that said, hey, we need to properly vet this guy. I think you said he's maybe the least known figure ever to reach the presidency. And then there were people in the media at that time that were almost bragging about it. Like, yeah, and Hastings himself said, yeah, I swoon too. And it was almost like they were proud of it. So just coming to the premise of your 2010 book, I mean, that was pretty early on. Barack Obama comes in 2009. And you were, as I say, a rare exception that actually said, no, we need to look at his background. We need to consider his worldview. So I guess before you get to some of the content of your book, what was it that sort of got you going in that study?
Well, I think with Obama, there were a couple of key factors that explained why the media in general was so devotional in their coverage. The first was that, of course, Obama was black. That is the huge factor. First black president just created talk about a presidential immunity, right? An immunity from scrutiny. And nobody wanted him to fail. So as a result, it was, listen, whatever we got, we're going to prop this guy up. But the second factor was that Obama himself was, and I would contrast him, for example, with the Biden administration, Obama was very sneaky. He was covert about his agenda, and he was centrist in his rhetoric. If you listen to Obama when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention, I think this was 2004.
Right.
He, you know, there's no red America, there's no blue America, there's only the United States of America. Deafening applause, you know. And Obama knew how to prosecute a very left-wing agenda, but sounding like he had always at least taken into account the other guy's views. So even a lot of Republicans were, if not charmed by Obama, a little immobilized mm-hmm. by Obama. So yes, this guy came in, a messianic figure. Mm-hmm. And I was myself a little bit thrown off track at the very, very beginning because I didn't know much about Obama, and the media coverage was heavily focused on the fact that he was a civil rights hero. He was the reincarnation of Martin Luther King, if mm-hmm. you will. What King did for the law, Obama was going to do for the presidency and for public policy. And it just took a little bit of just cursory, scrutiny of Obama to realize, wait a minute,
That's not who Obama is. That's not his real background. That's not what motivates him. And again, this isn't like my viewpoint. This is Obama's viewpoint. Mm-hmm. Obama himself, quite in a very confessional way in his book, The Dreams from My Father, lays out what's important to him, lays out his story of development and how he became Obama.
Yeah, you made that point right at the start of your book. I'll just give you a quote. You said, Obama learned to see America as a force for global domination and destruction. And then further on, you said, Obama's anti-colonialism is deeply felt, and it suffuses his writings and speeches. So as you say, you're just getting it from him, basically. In fact, it is the moral and intellectual foundation of his ideology. In a sense, I'm saying nothing more than what Obama himself says, that his father's dream has become his dream. It's a dream that as president, he's imposing with a vengeance on America and the world. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the resistance that you met. It was first, I think you had an excerpted portion in a magazine, if I recall. I read that, then I'm like, I got to get the book. And then I have some clips, we can play them if we have time later, but it wasn't received very well. They thought you were really going after Obama without cause.
Well, Steve Forbes was the editor of Forbes magazine, and so I was talking to him at a Forbes conference about the fact that people are misreading Obama.
Right.
And I mentioned that I had read Dreams from My Father. I pointed out to Steve Forbes, first of all, I said, pay attention to the title. It's not Dreams of My Father. I'm not writing a bio of my father and what his dreams were. Dreams from My Father. Here are the dreams that I, Obama, got from my dad. So it's kind of important. That's his autobiography. What are those dreams? What was Obama's father's worldview?
Right.
And the answer to that happens to be very well known. His father was a kind of a public figure, certainly at least in Kenya. And his dominant way of thinking, his worldview, was anti-colonialism. I recognize this partly because India was a colonial property, if you will, of the British for a long time. In fact, it was the crown of the British Empire. And in India, as in many other parts of the world, in the second half of the 20th century, this anti-colonial ideology emerged. It was because of colonialism. It was anti-Western. Mm-hmm. It was anti-British specifically, but it also became anti-American because after World War II, it's almost like the baton of Western civilization passed from England to America. And so the premise of my study of Obama was if we assume that Obama took this anti-colonial ideology from his dad, as he says he did, how does that explain what he's doing? Mm-hmm. And it turned out it explains it very well.
Yeah.
But when Steve Forbes let me write the cover story for Forbes, and I wanted to put the article in a mainstream magazine, not in National Review or a conservative magazine, caused a big stir because the White House went berserk. They like called in their Forbes people in Washington, screamed at them like, why are you guys doing this? And what a disgraceful attack on, you know, our, you know, demigod here, Obama. And I found all of this very amusing and entertaining.
Did you have like a team of researchers? You've written so many books. I'm sure you have a few that have helped research and that sort of thing over the years.
I mean, typically I have one, you know, in other words, I will bring on a young college graduate, someone in their 20s.
Right.
For some years, I had a pipeline to Dartmouth because I went there and there was a conservative newspaper there that I was part of. So I would hire kids out of Dartmouth. Sometimes I just found them in San Diego, where I lived at the time. And this would be sort of my fact checker, my gopher, but the books I found, I would pretty much do most of it myself.
Right.
Because number one, I take a lot of pride in the crafting of the books, the actual writing of it. And the second, you just have to be very, particularly when you're taking on a sacred cow like Obama, you need to be very, very thorough and very exact with regard to footnotes.
Right.
And so, because everything is going to be checked. Our culture now has become more casual. I mean, look at all these cases of plagiarism being discovered. And obviously, they weren't discovered for years because no one's checking. Mm-hmm. But when I published the Obama book, really a decade ago, you had to assume that every footnote, someone is going to go look at your quotation, go look at the original source, not just for the quote, but for the context.
Right. So you mentioned going to Forbes, like you wanted to go to a mainstream outlet to release the first version of this. Some of the clips that our team pulled together are you going on to CNN or same thing, you know, and they didn't like it at all. They kind of attacked you. They said it was not based in fact. And that sort of Elliot Spitzer, I think, was one when he was on with CNN. That's again, this is years ago. But was that also something that you wanted as your strategy? Like, I need to get this more to the left and let them wrestle with it.
Yeah, I think that our culture was a little less polarized then. And it's important to realize that Obama himself was an agent of polarization. So you can almost talk about American culture before Obama and after Obama. And there's the wedge, there was a bit of a wedge, but it went much deeper.
Right.
So, for example, it was not abnormal for me to go on shows like CNN. And because, remember, CNN had a show called Crossfire. They have someone on the left, they have someone on the right, which would be inconceivable for CNN to do now. And there was a sense that there is a legitimate conservative point of view, just as there's a point of view from the left. And we need to sort of hear both, and we need to hold the one up against the other. So people would argue about Obama. And the problem that they had, of course, was that Obama grew up in Hawaii in a very unconventional arrangement. His parents were both left-wing radicals of one type or another. They were very different from each other, but their left-wing radicalism held them together. That's how they came together in the first place. They had this in common. And Obama's mom later left the United States and went to Indonesia,
right,
where she kind of took up with a guy over there because she also had this anti-colonial philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Obama was getting it from both sides, and his book is full of quotations about Western pillage and Western imperialism and stealing the oil wealth of the non-West and so on. So I was on very firm ground. And then Obama was doing things like, I'm going to remove the Winston Churchill bust from the White House.
Right.
Now, that's not normally something that you'd want to do, because even Democrats and liberals in the United States like Churchill. He's known by and large as the hero of World War II.
Right.
But for anti-colonialists, he's known as the guy who presided over the British Empire, the guy who ridiculed Gandhi, the guy who supported Western imperialism in Kenya, which is, of course, where Obama's father is from. And so there's a hatred toward Churchill based on that. But that is not even well known in America. But Obama knew it because he got it from his dad.
Right. Yeah, you talk in your book, you talk about the uprising in Kenya, I believe, is in the 50s. And was that when Churchill came back for that later? I know he was out for a while, and then he came back as prime minister. But did he have a direct hand in crushing that uprising?
Yeah, there was a Churchill was definitely both a. Churchill basically thought it was a tragedy that World War II was bringing the British Empire
right.
to an end, and he saw his job as one of holding on to it as much as he could.
Yeah.
He was a genuine believer in the old school that the empire was, on the balance, a good thing.
Right.
Now, ironically, over the years, today, you will find many Indians and many people who come from that background who will defend the empire in exactly the Churchillian mode.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not common in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s. And in fact, it wasn't common even when I was a student in the late 70s and 80s, you could not say a good word about colonialism. I've been a little bit of a maverick. I wrote an article in a very prestigious academic magazine called The Chronicle of Higher Education called Two Cheers for Colonialism. I didn't go as far as to do three cheers, but I thought I'd do two cheers. And that caused a big stir because all these academics started screaming at me. And they were, of course, particularly offended that an Asian Indian would be making this point,
right,
which was a very Churchillian point. So, yes, the massacres of that are now pretty well documented. And it's quite clear that there was a lot of excess and there were a lot of people who were just imprisoned, essentially, without being tried. And there were quite a few people who were hanged in retaliation. So all of this was a smoldering memory, certainly mm-hmm. for Barack Obama Sr. And Obama himself, who always saw himself as a kind of a citizen of the world.
Yeah.
When you listen to him talk, for example, in Cairo, some of the other speeches, you don't even get the idea that he sees himself as, I'm representing the United States, I'm defending U.S. interests. It's just not the way he thought about things.
Right. My father really is drawn attention to the fundamental transformation, that comment he made in 2008. Was that something, that statement, that was just a few days before the election, did that sort of concern you to say something like what needs to be fundamentally transformed?
I think it did, but only in retrospect. In other words, I don't think when it was first said that the full significance of it sank into me. In other words, it's not uncommon as boilerplate rhetoric. You come, we're about to change America. You know, this is something you could hear from Republicans or Democrats. So I think initially I took it in that spirit. It's essentially what Obama is saying was, my election means that the Reagan era is over. Because I think it's fair to say the Reagan era, which began in 1980, kind of came to an end in 2008. So Obama was right about that. What we didn't see immediately, although it became quickly apparent, is that Obama wanted to take a lot of things that we identify with American exceptionalism. If you say America is good because, and then you list 10 things, he wanted to change all those 10. Kind of a startling idea. I don't think most Americans had even a clue about this. And Obama himself was pretty stealthy about going about it. Mm-hmm. You'll very rarely hear him make direct and explicit attacks on these things. He'll never say things like, you know, I'm against ladders of opportunity. I don't want people to start at the bottom of the ladder and come up. Or I don't want America to be a force for good in the world. In fact, this is part of his chameleonic rhetoric, where he sounds fairly traditional, but his agenda is anything but.
Right. So the Obama's Rage book, that's 2010. Then you come out with Obama's America in 2012. That's an election year. He's running for, I haven't gone through that book as much, but how does that message add to what you had revealed in the previous book?
Essentially, it's an update. In other words, in 2010 really reflected just 1 year of Obama. He came in early 2009, as you mentioned, January. So the book came out, in the middle of 2010. So it captured the early moves of Obama, right? But by 2012, he had been in for almost 4 years.
Right.
He was running for re-election, and a lot had happened. The Arab Spring. And so the question really was, was my framework as laid out in the Roots of Obama's Rage, could it be validated by looking at the entire first term of Obama's presidency? And second, would it be predictive of what Obama would do in the second term?
Mm-hmm.
So the second book, Obama's America, is the companion to the film, 2016 Obama's America, and they came out at the same time.
Right.
So it captures all of the first term. And it predicts the second term, and in retrospect, it's kind of fun to go back and watch the movie or go back and read, because I think if someone read Obama's America today, they'd be like, yeah, that's obviously what Obama is. Although at the time, people were like, even National Review, the kind of, at that time, stalwart publication of the right, was sputtering with confusion with Dinesh, they were a little upset with me. But not only because they felt my criticism of Obama was too harsh, but they also thought I was racializing the critique of Obama, even though I didn't say a word about really blackness. That wasn't my point. My point was, when you come from a certain part of the world, Africa, you develop an outlook on the world. This was Barack Obama Sr., completely different from what let's say, one would develop by growing up, say, in Peoria or in Minnesota. And so I was saying that as someone who's myself come to America from a third world country, I can bring that anti-colonial insight and apply it to Obama, and then you can see how it illuminates Obama. It brings Obama completely to life.
Yeah.
When Obama and Michelle are sort of, you know, jostling each other and going something like, why are we making this big deal about an American flag? Now, see, Biden wouldn't say that. Jimmy Carter wouldn't say that. It takes a particular way of looking at America to see the flag itself as a symbol of oppression. Now, today, again, it's familiar, the Gaza encampments. Obama's ideology has become much more mainstream on the progressive left.
Yeah. So, and you were telling me over the weekend that when your books were coming out and you were making these pretty stunning revelations, you had friends that were saying, we need to get this to a larger audience. And this is before you became a filmmaker. That first movie of yours, Obama's America, I think, and I watched it over the weekend again, and you, I think it says up front, this is based on these two books, Obama's Rage and Obama's America. What was, maybe you can tell our viewers, what was your thinking coming into, okay, now I want to make a film about this content?
So, I have a friend, Joe Ricketts, who is the founder of Ameritrade, the big bank, and Joe's a great guy. He's a billionaire, and he really liked my book, The Roots of Obama's Rage, and he said, Dinesh, I've come up with a great idea. I'm going to buy a full page ad in the Wall Street Journal promoting your book, and I go, Joe, you know, it's that'll cost you $50,000. A lot of money, even today, but at the time, for sure. And I said, and I'll sell a couple of hundred books, but it's not even going to come close to 50 grand.
Right.
So it's not a wise investment. But he ignored me. He just did it. He went ahead and did it. And sure enough, I met up with him, and he's like, how are we doing? And I'm like, well, we sold a couple of hundred books, kind of like I told you. And he's like, well, it's so frustrating, Dinesh. I want to get this message not to a few thousand people or even 100,000 people, but to like 1 million people, 5 million people. How do we do that? And I go, well, you can't do that with a hardcover book. That's a limited audience. And if you sell 100,000 books in a hardcover book, you're going to be like number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. So I said, you have to make a film. And I said, I remembered myself that Michael Moore had made Fahrenheit 9/11 a few years earlier. And he goes, yeah, we should do that. So he said, why don't you go look into it? And so I talked to a couple of guys I knew who were connected with documentary films. And they did a little budget for me. And they said, basically, for $2.5 million, we can make this film. So I went back to Joe. I said, you know, it's going to cost me $2.5 million if I do this. And so he writes a check for $100,000 and he goes, listen, find 24 other people to be your investors in this project. And so I did. It took me a little while, but I pulled it off. And that provided the equity budget to make this film. I found a film director named Jim Hanen, mm-hmm. Good guy. And Jim explained to me that a documentary film is a little different than a book. A book is a legal brief. It's an essay. And in a book, you can actually state your conclusions in advance and say, this is who I think Obama is. Let me show you in the next 10 chapters why what I'm saying is true. I'm going to look at Obama here, Obama there. And Jim said, a film doesn't work like that. A film is a journey.
Mm-hmm.
So a film will state a problem or a question up front.
Mm-hmm.
That's act one, framing the problem. Act two is the journey in which the audience goes along with you. And in this case, I went to Hawaii, I went to Indonesia, I went to Kenya. So it's like a developing investigative quest. And at the end of act two, it's like, we know who Obama is. And he's actually not what we thought. It's not what people think. And so act two concludes with a sort of revelation about this is the real Obama. And then act three becomes, and now what? So now that we know that this is Obama, what does this mean? What do we do about it? What have we inherited here? What is our response to what we know? So that is the, I would call it the classic structure of a documentary film. And so I had to learn in this new format, which is a visual format. It's not about talking. You don't want to just have a bunch of people saying, oh, Obama this, Obama that. You want to move the story along, and you want to, it's almost like taking, you know, it's like taking the audience on a tour. Mm-hmm. But this is a tour into Obama's world.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. That's what became the film 2016. And it really struck a chord because it's, again, a film is show, not tell. And so it's not like at the end of it, I'm saying this is who Obama is. You have actually gone along with me and you have seen Obama's world and you've heard people very close to him and to his dad. You've met his brother. You've seen me at the Obama homestead in Kogelo, a small village in Kenya. And so you're like, this guy knows what he's talking about. And I have heard for myself. And this whole side of Obama, I have seen nothing about in the media.
Right.
Not a word. So it was a completely fresh angle on Obama.
Yeah. You went to Kenya, as you say. You talked with his, I think in one case, it was his younger brother who then called you later. I saw this on C-SPAN a while back. But he called you later because his son was sick in the hospital. And
yeah,
maybe you could just quickly tell that.
Well,
story.
This is fast forwarding now to I was president of the King's College 2012, and my assistant comes up and says, "Oh, we have a call from George Obama," and I'm like, "George Obama from Kenya?" Now I had interviewed George Obama 2 years prior for the film, so I knew who he was, of course, but I thought it was really odd that he was calling me. And so I pick up the phone and George is like, "Oh, Dinesh," you know, he's like, I need help. I've got a young son who's very sick. I'm actually at the hospital right now." And George Obama is a little bit of a scam artist. So like I mentioned to you, I'm like, "George, put the nurse on the phone. Let's hear about what's really going on." But he was telling the truth. And so he said he needed $1,000. And I just sort of stepped back and thought to myself, you know, I can help him and I'm going to help him. But I thought, how odd. Here you have a guy who's the half-brother of the President of the United States, a guy with immense influence and access to immense resources. And yet he's calling me,
right,
not his brother. And right there, that encapsulates the utter hypocrisy of Obama. He'll go on and give speeches about we are our brother's keeper.
Right.
He won't help his own brother.
Right. So your book goes, both books, a few hundred thousand readers, to then, as you told me the other day, your movie is seen by 6-7 million people. How did the Obama, he's still in the presidency, I mean, this is getting close to the reelection in November of 2012, but did you get a sense of how his administration responded to the movie?
Yeah, they would routinely denounce it. And I think Obama himself, oddly enough, Obama maintained his own website, barackobama.com. You'd think when you're president that this would now become like, but it was Obama because there were unsigned editorials. And so I would be attacked by name and the film, clearly by Barack Obama. And I could even recognize his cadence because Obama has a certain way of talking, you know. He and it's very unique. It's not even a normal type of presidential talk. He's always posing as an intellectual. I said because he's not a real intellectual, but he's a would-be intellectual. He'll say things like, "Well, we have to make a distinction between ISIS and ISIL." He doesn't actually know the distinction, but it makes him sound smart. So that's Obama, and so I'm like, yeah, that's Obama. I know him well enough now that I would probably recognize it even if I were to. And so I could tell that this guy was unnerved and angry because if I had done a movie that was like a critique of Obamacare, he wouldn't care. That'd just be another critique out there.
Right.
There were many others doing the same thing. But what I did was I burrowed into his soul and into his world and exposed him as a fraud, as a hypocrite, as a joke. And I think this is what he found very unnerving. And so his ultimate retaliation was to essentially unleash the Justice Department on me in a preview of subsequent politicization of the deep state, of the so-called police state. Obama, I think, got the FBI to get my bank records because at the time, a college friend of mine was running for office.
So this is still 2012 or 2013?
2012.
Okay, so right as the movie.
Right as the movie. The movie's in the theater. Okay. And my friend is Wendy Long, running for the Senate in New York. A very quixotic, kind of unwise project because, you know, to run for Senate in New York, you can get the Republican nomination, but you need $25 million to run a competitive campaign. And against an incumbent, no less. And so I advised her not to run. But I said, okay, well, you're my friend, so if you do run, I will help you. And so the campaign finance limit was $10,000. And so I wrote her a check for $10,000. And so I had hit the limit. But what happened is Wendy was, you know, because her campaign was struggling, she was always asking me to do other things. Like, oh, Dinesh, you know, we have some Indian doctors. Can you come and meet with them? Because, you know, you're Indian, they're Indian. Maybe they'll end up contributing to my campaign. Hey, I'm doing an event in Scarsdale. Can you come and say a few words? And because I was traveling the country promoting my film, I couldn't do any of this.
Right.
So I kind of felt bad.
Right.
So I thought, well, look, maybe I can figure out a way to get her some more money. So I called two friends of mine and I said, hey, listen, do you like Wendy Long? They're like, yeah. I'm like, give her $10,000 and I'll reimburse you. Now, this is, I should not have done this, but this is how I exceeded the campaign finance law because I ended up giving her $30,000.
Right.
10 and then 10 through two of my friends. So look, this is the kind of thing that unfortunately, I mean, a lot of it happens, right? And usually when it happens, people are looking for some kind of gain.
Right.
So for example, let's say a guy is a partner in a law firm. He wants to help Obama because he wants to become, let's say, ambassador to the Bahamas.
Right.
And so he gets his other eight law partners to all contribute to Obama, and then he funnels business their way so they make that money back, right? This happens all the time. It's never prosecuted.
Right.
Because it's considered to be, unless there is blatant quid pro quo, I'll give you $100,000 secretly and you make me a judge. That's not allowed. That's what the campaign finance law is for. But in Dinesh's case, in my case, I was giving money to a candidate who was a longtime friend. I got nothing to gain out of it. I didn't even tell Wendy Long I was doing it.
Right.
And so there was no quid pro quo. No prior involvement in anything like this. So normally it would be like, okay, we're going to give you a warning. We're going to give you a fine. We're going to give you 100 hours of community service. But because Obama was like, let's use the law to go get this guy. And let's file the case with a judge who is like in our pocket, so that this judge will then impose a very severe sentence and pretend like it's all on the up and up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like you catch a guy for speeding, but the law is open-ended. And so what you do is instead of him getting $200 fine, he gets 1 year in prison. Now it's like, what? I mean, yeah, I did speed, but who gets 1 year in prison for speeding?
Right.
That's what happened to me.
So did you go into court basically and say, well, yeah, I did do this.
Yeah.
I gave $30,000 and I gave it, you know, 20 of it through two friends. And
I did. And I told the judge, I go, listen, my defense is not that I didn't do it, it's selective prosecution. In other words, I am being singled out for this, even though it happens commonly, and not to mention when other people have done it, and in some cases they have been held accountable for it, their penalties are unimaginably lighter than mine.
Right.
You have a guy who gave not $20,000, but like $200,000 through a whole network of donors to the Democrats.
Right.
Indian guy, as it turns out. He was a hotelier, and he got absolutely no incarceration. He just got some sort of a fine and probation, and he was off the hook.
So the penalty was you had a fine, you had 5 years probation, and then you had 8 months in sort of a halfway house.
Yeah.
What was the eight? You touched on this in your lecture the other night, but what was the what did the 8 months entail?
It's 8 months in what they call a confinement center. A confinement center is a kind of a limited type of prison. It's a facility with guards. You will sleep in a dorm, typically 60 people to a room on bunk beds, two floors. And it's the full gamut of criminals. So some are white collar, the minority. The majority are going to be usually people who have served a fairly lengthy sentence. They're on their way back to society. Mm-hmm. And so the halfway house is exactly that. It is a transition from prison to normal life. And typically the way it works is that you are confined at night, but in the day you're allowed to get out and go work. Now you're still under conditions. You know, you cannot drink alcohol. There are lots of things you can't do. And then you take a breathalyzer and go through a metal detector when you come back. So what I would do is I would check in typically at 7 at night. And then I would check out at about 7 in the morning.
And you said that, you told Sam and I the other day that some hardened criminals that were, as you say, being phased back into society and had been in there for robbery, murder, and all these things, describe their reaction when you told them what you were in there for.
Well, what happens is they pretty quickly, these guys, and a lot of them are pretty similar. A lot of them were, well, first of all, because it was San Diego, a lot of them were Hispanic. Quite a few of them were involved in, they were coyotes and involved in across the border stuff, drugs. And there were a couple that were involved in the Mexican mafia gangs, things like that. So right away, they were like, well, who's this guy? Because they could tell I was, in a way, very different than they were. And mostly kept to myself. I, wasn't part of the group. And now, what protected me, and I knew this, and this helped me a lot, was these guys were all, 60, 90 days from getting out. So I knew they're not going to be in the mood to want to stab me or punch me, because they're going to get another 10 years if they do that.
Right.
So they don't want that. So that gives you a certain type of protection. Quite honestly, the people I was most afraid of was the U.S. government, the prison authorities. I thought if they plant drugs in my locker, I will never be able to prove it wasn't mine.
Right.
And they control my locker. They can do that easily. Yeah. So this really shows you how this was a experience for me, because I recognize I actually trust the U.S. government less than I do the criminals who are with me. But they would ask me, so what are you in for, And because you'd kind of swap. That's your basic information. What are you in for is question number one, even before your name.
Right.
And so I was it's hard for me to explain. So I'd be I did a campaign finance law, violate. Oh, what's that? So I'm like, well, basically, I said I was convicted of giving away too much of my own money. And you can just imagine the impact of making a statement like that. These are people who cannot understand. To them, a crime is taking somebody else's money, not giving away your own.
Right.
And so first of all, they thought I was kidding, that they're be serious and stuff like that. I'm like, no, that is what I did. And they're like, man, that is some, that is some weird ass, they could not believe it. And they kind of became, I wouldn't say fans of mine, but they came to realize that something was up here.
Yeah.
And ultimately, even the prison authorities who were, they're just doing their job, they too started recognizing that something was up, and I think it started because I had a mandatory court hearing in New York, so I had to fly from San Diego to New York, and obviously because of that I stayed overnight. But because I stayed overnight, I went on the Megyn Kelly show that night on Fox News, and this was part of my way of using the media to push back. But it made me an instant celebrity, because when I came back to the confinement center, one of the guards was like, wait, did I see you last night on Megyn Kelly? And so he told everybody else. And then pretty soon all these guards and stuff were like, I wouldn't say there's no such thing as special treatment, because I was getting the same treatment as everybody else. But on the other hand, they were friendly to me, and they would accommodate my requests within reason.
So after the 8 months, you serve your time. Did the Obama DOJ continue to harass you in any way?
They really couldn't, but because I had completed my sentence. But I did have a probation officer. And what that means is that the probation officer controls your travel,
mm-hmm.
and can come and show up at your house at any time and search.
Yeah.
So it was kind of awkward. I mean, I was, Debbie, my wife, was like, this is really strange and stuff like that. And also Debbie was a CHL, a concealed, she had a license to have a concealed gun, and she had done gun training and things like that. But on the other hand, the simple truth of it is, when you have a felony conviction, you cannot have a gun in the house. You can't, it's absolutely prohibited. So we were, living under those conditions. If I traveled particularly abroad and I took my passport and put it in the scanner, it would exit out.
Yeah.
And I'd have to go into a special room and typically show that I had permission to travel. In one or two cases, they would call my probation officer. You're living under scrutiny. I didn't have an ankle bracelet or anything, but I was free. But I was definitely And I couldn't vote. I couldn't certainly own a firearm. So it wasn't until I got a presidential pardon in 2018. So this is a few years later.
Right.
My case had concluded in 14. My sentence finished in 15. It was in May of 2018 that I got an official pardon from Trump, and it completely cleared my record.
So Trump comes in January of 2017.
Right.
And then, I mean, you don't have to reveal all of the inner workings and the names, but maybe you could just describe what led up to you getting the phone call from Donald Trump.
Well, fortunately, my wife is really good friends with Ted Cruz, and he agreed to ask Trump if he would pardon me. And that's kind of all it took. Trump apparently had been familiar with my case, not the details, but he'd heard about it. And I think his instinct was that they're going after Dinesh because of who he is, not because of what he did. This is a political witch hunt. And of course, I think Trump had no inkling that it would be happening to him 10 times over.
Well, and that's the point you made at your lecture the other night, is that really, your case was the first one. I mean, now you see all these January 6 protesters are being persecuted. Obviously, Donald Trump's being persecuted with these indictments. But this really was like a forerunner to everything that we're seeing now.
In retrospect, yes. I mean, at the time, I didn't look at it that way. I wasn't like, here's my case and it's a forerunner of the police state. No, I looked at it like, here's my case, and it's the case where the empire strikes back. I had a big sign on my back. I should have known that if I go after Obama, he's going to go after me. He's a vindictive narcissist. So I saw it as a one-off. And little did I know that Obama was inaugurating something that would escalate under Biden, a complete systematic repression of the opposition, repression of speech, that's the censorship industry, and then also political targeting.
Okay, so we've got 6-7 minutes left. Now, that, I mean, this book, 2010, that's, you know, 14 years ago. Your movie was 12 years ago. We're in 2024. It's another election year. How has your views, like, changed or you know, even been more enhanced on that message that you were coming out with 10, 12 years ago?
Well, it's not so much that I have changed. It's really, I think, more that there is now that we have a much better view of Obama. I think the mask has come off, and it took a while for that to happen. But I think people who today go back and look at the film or read the book would completely recognize Obama. I think that the interesting question for me today is whether we are living through Obama's third term and potentially headed to Obama's fourth term, which would give him an FDR-style control over the country. And you know, you can't fundamentally remake a country in one term. I don't even think you can remake it in two terms.
Right.
But you can remake it in four terms,
As
FDR did. America at the end of FDR was very different than it was before, not for the better, for the most part. And with Obama, the same. So I see the fingerprints of Obama continuing with Biden's policies. We know for sure that Biden is surrounded by Obamaites, Obama acolytes, and Obama staff from the Obama years. We also know that that Biden is not directly the one that is steering the canoe. He's in the canoe, and he's a collaborator. He's a willing he's willing to let himself be puppeteered by others. But who are those others? We don't know for sure, but the heavy betting is that this is essentially an Obama claque, an Obama gang, possibly led by Obama himself.
Yeah, and you told me the other night you feel like that they want to hang on to Biden as the puppet because he is, they can control him totally, whereas if it was some other, you know, up-and-coming Democrat that they replaced Biden with, he'd come in there and probably want to do, you know, some of his own ideas and policies. Whereas in this case, the puppet master is getting to do pretty much what he wants.
Yeah, and the ventriloquist likes the puppet because the ventriloquist controls himself and the puppet. So the whole routine depends on the ventriloquist being both people, right? Now, if you had, instead of a puppet, you had, let's just say, a
you know, a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old, that guy would say whatever he wants. The show would be ruined. It wouldn't work. So I think that the puppeteer is like having a puppet. They are essentially a junta running the country. We don't even know who they are. So in a sense, it's very alarming. We're in a perilous stage because we're a democracy on the surface, on the facade, but we don't even know. I mean, even authoritarian societies abroad, we know who's running them. We know Xi is running China. We know Putin's running Russia. We don't even know who's running our own country.
Do you think that, I mean, going back to Obama's influence, you said earlier about his first and second term that, you know, what he said didn't square with what he was actually doing. Do you feel like now he's just, because he's hiding a bit behind the puppet, that he's just taking the mask off? I mean, you see the wide open invasion at the border and just all of these policies that got their start under Obama when he was in the Oval Office.
Yeah, in a way, Obama doesn't have to manage his own reputation anymore because he's operating indirectly. Any backlash that came to, let's say, an open border policy would hit Biden, not Obama. So Obama is able to try things. It's kind of like if, you know, it's like if I go out in the field, I might get hurt. But if I have some surrogates, I can say, all right, well, go, you know, or you're a general, you're not rushing the hill. You tell these, so, you know, run up the hill, see what happens, you know. Machine gun fire, the guy gets killed. Oh, okay, well, it wasn't me. You know, you wouldn't run up the hill because you, then you'd be weighing it more carefully. So what I'm getting at with Obama was, I think in his own administration, he was, because he is a narcissist, he was very much the supervisor of his own image. He's like, I don't want to go too far over here. And, but I think when he is the puppeteer, he's perfectly willing to let the puppet take the risk.
Maybe your next book should be the fruits of Obama's fourth term. Let's hope it doesn't happen.
Well, you know, at the end of these two books, people will be like, Dinesh, like, why are you so obsessed with Obama? And I'm like, I'm not obsessed with Obama. I made a film called Hillary's America. You know, I've written about a lot of presidents. I wrote a book on Reagan. So in other words, I laid out a thesis about Obama. Had it been, you know, fundamentally mistaken, I might have had to do a clarification or do something subsequently. But I think that the two books, I'm proud of them because I think, I think it's been, that was a pivotal moment in 21st century history. I think historians will look back on it. So the book is not like one of those books that just becomes so dated that why would anybody even open it a decade later? No, it's actually very interesting to open it now. It pertains to things going on now. So I'm happy with that work. I wouldn't like redo it now, but it seems to me it's just part of the corpus of my work. And it represented a turning point, partly because it opened the door to the films. I've now done 7, working on number 8. So it created a new chapter in my career.
Dinesh D'Souza, thanks for joining us on the Trumpet Daily.
A pleasure.